Welcome to this interview. I'm Megan Gibson, your conference co-host. Today, I'm speaking with Ruth Wipman, an author, journalist, and essayist. Her most recent book is Boy Mom: Reimagining Boyhood in the Age of Impossible Masculinity. Ruth, thank you so much for being with us today.
Such a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Ruth, first of all, reading your book felt like reading my diary and the diary of my neighbor across the street who has three boys. It turns out that a lot of us in the care and keeping of young men are experiencing the same struggles and concerned about the same things. So I'd love it if you could tell us why you wrote this book and what it outlines are the challenges facing young boys and young men in this moment.
Yeah, so I've got three boys who are now 14, 11, and about to turn 7. And my youngest was born like in this really, really fraught cultural moment. So it was like right as the Me Too movement was just exploding online. We had this kind of global cultural reckoning around toxic masculinity and just all this evidence of men doing terrible things, just like one after another after another. Here's another terrible man and another terrible man. And it was a re you know, I'm a feminist. I was really like happy that the Me Too conversation was happening. It felt very validating as a woman. And, you know, that many of these sort of feminist ideas were being talked about in a whole new sort of systemic way. But at the same time, it was really tricky as a mother of boys to reconcile all of these kind of very conflicted feelings, you know. And it felt like it was just this moment where any kind of goodwill that anyone had ever had towards men and boys had just gone. It was like we were all angry. Men were the problem. They didn't have problems. They were the problem. That's something that Richard Reeves has talked about. And I just, you know, I wanted to reconcile kind of my mother self with my feminist self. How do we look at these kind of systemic issues in the way that we're raising boys? What are the pressures bearing down on boys? How have we normalized this kind of like violence in society, sexual assault. But what are the ways that boys are also harmed by this system? You know, they're not just causing harm to others. You know, the system clearly isn't working very well for them. And I wanted to bring some empathy and nurture to this conversation. You know, as a mom, I think a lot of my feminist peers, it was just like, let's write these awful jerks off completely, and they don't deserve any of our empathy. You know, they're so privileged, they have everything. And I think I wanted to look at this issue through a kind of empathetic lens.
Absolutely. And you know, you make a good distinction that it's not like the majority of young men are thriving in the in this environment. Like they're not saying we've got no problems here. I think we're finding that
Right.
there's a large rate of dissatisfaction, unhappiness, depression, you know, higher suicide rates.
Yeah.
There's plenty of evidence to suggest that men are also hurting too in this system.
Absolutely. I mean, I think that when it comes to loneliness, to friendship, to mental health, I mean, the male suicide rate at the moment, and especially for adolescent boys, is nearly four times the rate for female peers. Boys are struggling in school compared to girls. They're not going to college at the same rates. You know, that I think about 60% of college admissions are now girls and 40% are boys. You know, so boys in many ways are really falling behind girls. This system, however much privilege they may have in many ways, and that's also real, there are many ways in which the system just is not working for them. And I think that boys in our culture are being emotionally stunted, they're being socially stunted. You know, this is things are not going well for boys and men either.
So some of the most striking things that I read about in your book are some of the things that we know about boys and girls' developments as babies in social emotional learning and nurturing and things they need and their sensitivity. So I'd love it if you could share some of that with us because I think it's probably the first time other people have heard this too.
Yeah, this was really surprising. So I have this whole chapter where I dig into the kind of gender, the real like biological sex differences between males and females from infancy onwards. And this is such a controversial area because everybody's co-opted it for every kind of story, you know. But I think in general, when we talk about innate gender differences, we kind of think of boys as these like tough, sturdy, robust, you know, boys will be boys. They're like destructive. They're maybe a little aggressive. You know, those are the things we think of as being the innate gender differences. But actually, when you look at the research, pretty much by every measure, Boys are more sensitive, they're more emotionally vulnerable, and they're more fragile than baby girls. And the reason for this is because at birth, the right part of the brain, which is, and it's very easy to oversimplify, but broadly speaking, the right hemisphere of the brain is the part that deals with emotions and emotional self-regulation. So, like the ability to calm down when you're upset and attachment and relationships. That part of the brain is about a month to 6 weeks behind in a male infant than a female infant. So it's more vulnerable. The brain is more immature, which means it's more vulnerable to disruption. So anything that can kind of go wrong for a baby, like all the bad things that can happen to a baby, like abuse or neglect or poverty or poor living conditions, you can see in the data that they tend to have a bigger impact on boys than on girls. There's lots and lots of data on this. Boys are more physically vulnerable as well. You can see that, like, pretty much every type of developmental disability, neurodisability, death, illness, is et cetera, is more common in baby boys than it is in baby girls. Premature girls do significantly better. They have much better outcomes than premature boys. And this is because of this same thing, this brain immaturity. So it means that a baby girl is born slightly more independent, slightly more resilient, slightly more able to sort of calm down when she's unhappy. Girls in general cry a little less, they sleep a little better, they calm down more easily. So a baby boy actually needs more support from his caregivers than a baby girl on average. All of these things are group level differences. So, any one individual might have a different trajectory. But in general, boys need more support from caregivers. They need more care, more nurture in those early months. And really, actually, the boys' brains mature more slowly all the way through childhood. So actually, they need more support than girls. But because of the way, our kind of cultural stories about gender and our kind of gender stereotypes and what we believe that boys and girls need, we actually end up giving boys slightly less care than baby girls. We kind of masculinize them. We think of them as being more robust. So people like handle baby boys and girls differently. They throw boys around and they're like, "Hey there, little man," and throw them up in the air. Whereas girls receive around twice as much caretaking touch from their parents. We talk to boys less about their feelings. We're less likely to respond to their cries. These are small differences. They're not big differences. These are very subtle differences, but they're also real and they show up in data. Boys are more likely to get physically punished. They're more likely to get what researchers call hostile or confrontational parenting. The list goes on, and they're less likely, as they grow up, we don't talk to them about their emotions as much. We don't touch them as much. Teenage boys are one of the like most touch-starved groups of all groups of children, and about, I think the statistic is that a teenage boy is about twice as likely as a teenage girl to never be hugged or cuddled, which is tragic, and so it becomes this like double whammy. Boys need a little more care and they get a little less care in our culture. And together that means that the gap just grows and grows and grows in terms of, because obviously we learn social skills, we learn empathy, we learn how to care for others by being cared for ourselves. And the gap just widens and widens and widens as girls and boys grow up.
It's stark. It struck me so much. And I have to actually give you credit too, because I have a 15-year-old who's a freshman in high school. And from reading your work, I realized that there would definitely be full days in which my son never got a hug or never got any sort of, like, because of his schedule and temperament at 5 a.m. I mean, like, there's lots of factors involved. It's not neglect, but I was like, oh, I'm going to need to make an effort. And if he ever sees this interview, he's going to laugh. But like now, every single day, I make sure at some point in the day, I give him like an uncomfortably long hug, right? Where he's like, ah,
Yeah,
no.
but I think also it's like it becomes like a self-fulfilling prophecy because I think boys are so unused to it in a way that they're then like stiffen up and like, "Why are you touching me?" And I think it builds and builds, and we have to normalize it. And I think, we have a hard time in our culture seeing boys as vulnerable, and I think it will be really familiar to a lot of parents. I think that you're like worried about your daughter going out late at night, but you're not worried about your son. Even though boys are far more vulnerable to violence, like street violence, than girls are, they're significantly more likely to be the victim of violence, for example. But most parents, or many parents, are like, oh, protect your daughters and your sons are tough and strong and they're okay. And I think this inability to see boys as like vulnerable means that it's really hard for them to see themselves as vulnerable and to then respond to others in that way.
Yeah, how could you name your own vulnerability if nobody's ever
Named
actually
it for you.
acknowledged it to, yeah, if nobody's,
Right.
if you don't see yourself as deserving of nurturing, then how
Right.
can you ask for it or name it or, yeah, any of those
Right. And
things?
it's never been modeled to you. You just haven't received, so you don't know what you're missing. And I think there's an added layer onto it, which is just not just that they've never received it. It's also somehow seen as a little shameful. You know, masculinity norms mean that vulnerability is shameful, showing weakness is shameful, needing care is shameful for boys. And so it's like, it's really hard for them to acknowledge that. I see that with my own sons all the time. No matter how much I try to correct for it, it's just coming from everywhere in the culture.
Absolutely. And I want to name kind of, you made this distinction between neglect and under nurturing, right? We're not
Yeah.
talking about neglect is like obviously overt abuse, whereas under nurturing is such a more subtle and
It's very
covert.
subtle. It's very subtle. And it's like, I think it's something that, you know, we all have subconscious biases about everything, about gender, about race, and, you know, we're all acting them out all the time. So this obviously isn't like you're leaving your baby to cry for hours, or you're leaving them on a doorstep, or you're not feeding them. Of course, you know, and often, you know, and I think this shows up a lot with dads in particular, that often this sort of undernurture is not done from like a place of like neglect. It's done from a place of love. It's from a place of like, this is what a boy needs to be successful in life. They need to toughen up. They need to be stronger. They need to man up, you know. And so, you know, the people, parents feel like they're giving boys what they need in order to thrive in our culture. And really, actually, it can be quite harmful for them.
Yeah, we think we're giving them the tools that they need to deal with the circumstances that the world is going to hand them when actually
Absolutely.
what they need to deal with all that hardness and judgment and all of that on the
Yeah.
outside is like deep, nourishing
Care, right.
connection. Yeah.
It's so true. And I think once I started, and also I think it becomes even more fraught in this like particular moment, like this particular moment in history, that like we're talking about toxic masculinity, we're talking about boys being bad. And I think from my point of view, my response to all of that was to kind of panic and think, oh, I need to be really harsh with my boys and be really like discipline them and make sure that they don't do these terrible things and be really strict with them. And not to kind of feel like I'm mollycoddling them or enabling them in some way. And actually, once I started to think about this in terms of vulnerability rather than like innate like badness or aggression or destructiveness or whatever, it was much easier for me to reconcile all the different parts, I think, you know, to just think this is what they need, more care, not less care.
Yeah, absolutely. I keep thinking about this moment as I was reading your book. It was during COVID lockdowns and both my kids were home, schooling from home, and we're lucky enough we live in Florida and we have a pool. And there was still to this day, my kids are like in their teens. They cannot be in the pool alone, not because they can't swim beautifully, but because it always ends in someone trying to drown someone, right? It's just like
Yes.
it's infuriating. And I remember I just burst into tears and I looked at my husband and I was like, I cannot be feminist enough to out masculine. Like, I can't do it. It's not possible for me to. So, and I've since changed in that, like, there's an acceptance of aggression. There's an acceptance of the physicality
Yeah.
of what it means to be a boy or masculine or whatever. And also, like, when they're not doing that, my job is to nurture and care and connect and
Right,
all
right.
those things. Yeah.
And even when they are doing that, I mean, this is the hard thing. And I have it so much, you know. And I've had this whole chapter in the book about how I go into like parenting boys with all this like hubris. I'm like, oh, I'm going to do better. I'm going to be this great feminist mom. I'm not going to be
Right.
like boys will be boys and let them get
No
away with this.
Nerf
But my boys,
guns and no, yeah.
my boys will be different. They won't be that. And, you know, the only reason why boys behave like that is because people let them behave like that. And I was blindsided by my three boys. They were all the things, you know. Not only did they like love Nerf guns and every possible like violent toy, violent show, and they were just wild. They were absolutely the most physical wild, the play fighting, which would just like tip over, that thing where
There's
it's kind
always
of
an
play and
escalate.
it
It always
just like escalates.
escalates. Yeah.
And then it's just like, it's like kind of like a bar fight. Do you know what I mean? It's like starts off and then it just escalates, and then suddenly someone's bleeding and oh God, And so it's really hard because as a feminist and as a parent, I think we're encouraged in general in American parenting to believe we have all this control. It's kind of your fault if you get it wrong. And so with Boy Mom, I didn't want to write a parenting book which would just be like, do these three things and you'll get this outcome, because I read so many of those and they just made me feel awful because none of the things would work. So it's like I have some principles in there which are like, this is the way you can think about it, this is what the research says, this is what the culture is doing, this is like what we can unpack from the way the culture's going. But I don't see it as this like one for one that you have like this complete control over how they're going to turn out in that way.
Absolutely. Yeah. And you
It's
spoke to that. It was,
messy.
I'm so glad that you spoke to it because I could really relate to that when I had one kid. I remember kind of my narcissistic tendency, as you named it, to think that like this child was a direct reflection of my parenting. And then I had the second, and I was like, oh, I have very little to do with any of this and have very little
It's
control over any of it. Yeah.
so true. And like for good and for bad, it's like we have three kids. In some ways they're very similar, in other ways they're so different. And like, pretty much every trait that you can name is like a well brought up trait. At some times they've shown them, and at other times they haven't shown them. And it doesn't mean that parenting doesn't matter. It's just like, this is really complicated, and they're human beings that are trying to assert themselves. And let's just be honest about the mess of all this.
Yeah, and you name at one point the centers of the brain that are responsible for, organized thinking and impulse control and all of that, like the same delay that exists in that right brain development in infants exists in the prefrontal cortex part of the brain that's in control of all the, self-control and all of that and executive management and planning and things like that, all through, the school years and major developmental, and it's like a 2-year delay or something between
Two-year
boys and
delay.
girls.
Yeah, it's sort of between a 1 and 2 year delay. So it's, yeah, so boys are just behind developmentally. And I think that what the story has been like classically has just been like, or not classically, but like recently has been like a kind of gender essentialism, which is just like, well, they're immature, that's just what they're like, so let's give up, let's just like not bother. And I think we'll just like work around how limited they are. But actually, I think it's just an opportunity to kind of support them more, help them more, to do more. I think the boys will be boys is like, oh, let's just do less parenting and forget about it. And I think it's more a sort of invitation to do more and to see them in a slightly different way. And I think sometimes there's this like limiting language that we're using around boys in this moment. Like with girls, there's so much inspirational language. So you just wouldn't have, even if there are gender differences that favor boys, you wouldn't be like, oh, well, girls can't throw, girls can't run, girls are like physically behind. You'd see it as like they talk about it in an inspirational way. It's like girls can do anything, they just need to practice. The sky's the limit, the future's female. Whereas with boys, it's like boys can't sit still, boys can't, they don't like reading, they don't like this, they can't. And I think it's just like, I think there's got to be a way that we can be aware of some broad gender differences, but still believe that people can change, that we can be expansive, that we can offer opportunities, that we can talk about them in a way that's not incredibly limiting.
Absolutely. Yeah. In the example that you gave, I'm thinking about like, strength training and boys and girls. And it's like, it's not that girls can't build muscle, it's that they might need different adaptation, different nutrition, different, like we're going to support them more because that particular skill might be harder or more challenging for them physically. It's the same thing with boys. Like just because they might be a little bit behind or it might be developmentally more challenging doesn't mean they don't still need the psychoeducation and the support.
That it's just like, oh, well, there's nothing we can do, let's just give up. And same with like interests. I think sort of, a lot of girls go through like a princess phase, and nobody's saying, well, that's just what girls like, so let's just give them more princesses and nothing else ever. Nobody's saying, well, just like it's biologically determined that that's what, that's what they're going to like, so let's just not even try anything else, and it would just be shameful to even introduce anything else to them. It's like, let's try some different things, let's offer some different, and I think with boys it's just like, well, that's what they like, that's all they like, and so therefore, there's nothing we can do.
Yeah, and you also describe kind of the only way, and I've found this to be true, that boys are socializing now is via video games, and that there's not, there's, I think you said it's no hellos, no goodbyes,
Oh yeah,
no.
no highs, no byes, hello, no hellos or something. Yeah, that was something that a
Yeah.
boy said. Yeah, I mean that has been a huge thing. So I think there were lots of different things going on in there. One, just like the sort of on the face of it, just the data shows that screen time in the moment, you know, we talk about it a lot, and in many ways the conversation is focused on girls, but actually this phenomenon of like replacing in-person socializing with screen-based socializing is a much more significant problem for boys at the moment. Boys are spending around 5 hours more than girls on screens per week, and about, I think, a similar amount of time less hours socializing than girls. You know, they're you know, spending less time socializing in person with peers than same age girls are. And I think also it's partly because socializing in general, I think, is more fraught for boys than it is for girls. And they haven't really been taught those skills of connection and intimacy and vulnerability and intimate friendships. It's not modeled to them. Like, I wrote a whole chapter on popular culture, and it's just like, just in the stories they read and watch and the movies and the TV, girls get modeled over and over again how to have these intimate friendships, all these stories about, you know, pairs of best friends and like taking care of your friends, doing emotional labor, friendship dramas, nurturing. And those stories are just so almost non-existent for boys. You just don't see boys in those roles in like books and movies and shows. And so it's just like over and over again, it's not really modeled to boys and girls. And I think it's pretty fraught in the real world now. And so it's just easier to like slip into this screen-based social world in this moment.
And spend a ton of time together, but not actually share anything real, right?
Right, exactly. And that was, you know, so I was really sort of surprised when I spoke to boys. Like, I interviewed many boys, probably around 50 boys of like teenagers and college age kids, different backgrounds, different geography, different whatever. And I thought that they would just be like, oh, well, that's what we like. We don't want to have more in-person connection, or we don't want to like share our vulnerable feelings. And that is not what they were saying at all. Pretty much every single one of them was like, I would love to have deeper, more supportive relationships with my friends, but I feel like my friends would laugh at me. I don't know how to go about it. I don't have the skills. I don't even know where I would start. It's just culturally, socially, and just personally was so difficult for them to get started with it, but they really craved it.
Yeah, I'm so glad that you made that point because it's not like they enjoy the way that they relate to one another. They're craving depth
Right.
and support and connection, but they
They're
just don't know how
great.
to do
Right.
it.
They don't know how to do it. And they would like look to girls to provide it for them. And I think we see that modeled, you know, we see that, or many of us see that in adult relationships, where so many of my female friends are like, oh my God, I'm my male partner's like entire social support system. I'm his only like confidant. He doesn't talk about this stuff with his male friends. Da, da, da. And, you know, and this is something that starts in childhood. And so many men are lonely now. They want more connection. It's a crisis, but they just don't know how to do it.
Absolutely. And, you know, that leads to problems like depression, right? And you were saying in the book that depression for men looks a lot different than it can look for women. So, what are some of the ways that it looks different?
Well, so I think for men, because they don't have the sort of social permission to just be like straightforwardly sad and to express it as sadness and tell everyone that they're feeling depressed, that it can often come out in other ways. So like more aggression, more irritability, substance use, alcoholism, violence, you know, these kinds of things. You know, our outlets, we don't really give boys a very sort of developed emotional repertoire to express these things. And we don't really give them the social permission. So they feel they have to keep it inside. So you see this kind of like rage-filled substance abusing boy or man, and it doesn't look like, oh, sad, crying, you know, whatever. But the problem is, and that often the statistics around depression can get really skewed. So it looks like in the statistics that girls are more depressed than boys because they report it more often. But that a lot of that is just a feature of they're just not prepared to tell the person who calls up that that's how they're feeling. And then it gets so late. They don't, boys are much less likely to seek help for depression. They're much less likely to talk to someone, to talk to a teacher, to talk to a friend, to like report it. And then it's too late. And so the male suicide rate is several times that of the female one. And it's a tragedy. You know, it's a real tragedy.
And so many of those behaviors that you were speaking of earlier, you said in the book that, we address boys with for behavior problems instead
Yeah.
of giving them mental health support.
It's so true. I mean, it's like we tend to view, I wrote in the book, boys as bad, not sad, because it, and it's like right from the beginning, it's like it becomes this compounding problem. So even with little boys, it's like often they get funneled into these like disciplinary systems in school or at home. You know, we punish them and it looks behavioral when actually it's emotional. So if we could treat these things as emotional problems and give them support and nurture, it's a better way to get them out of these things. But you know, we tend to like punish them and be harsher and harsher and harsher, and then it kind of makes them feel more alienated, more, you know, further and further from society, further and further from health seeking, makes them feel ashamed and bad inside.
And we're seeing kind of a drawing of these folks to the political right. Why is that happening?
Yeah, well, I think that the political left has not done a great job of articulating that patriarchy and these norms, masculinity norms, harm men. I think in this moment, it's sort of we're more about, and it's understandable why this has happened, but I think it's become this kind of cultural divide where the left sees itself as broadly on the side of girls and women, and everything to do with boys and men is kind of slightly right-wing coded. And like to empathize with men, it's almost seen as like a betrayal of feminism or progressive values. Like they're the enemy, don't care about them, they're privileged, they have everything, time for them to shut up. And I think there's this narrative, you know, they've got the old version of masculinity, which is like be tough, be strong, suppress your emotions. And now they've got these kind of new voices from the left, which are saying, you know, you're taking up too much space, don't talk about your feelings. Your pain is not as valid as somebody else's pain. You're the privileged one. Everything's great for you. Be quiet. So I think it's just different ways of shutting men down. And then along come these bad actors like the Andrew Tates, the masculinity influencers, the right, who are saying they have this very simple story. They're like, it's all women's fault. It's all feminism's fault. The reason why you're feeling terrible, I can restore you to back to this place of manly whateverness. And it's really appealing. They feel lost, and somebody's like not telling them they suck, you know?
Absolutely. And you said something striking in the book too about how there's a particular type of man who gets influenced into kind of this incel behavior. And if he's at the bottom of the hierarchy of men, the only person that he can be better than is women. And
Right,
so,
absolutely. I
yeah.
mean, it's this thing about hierarchical masculinity. So there's like the successful men at the top, you know, the alpha male, they call them, or the chads, the incels call them chads, you know, these like good looking, strong, successful men who are really successful with women and girls. And then there's like what they call the beta males, who are like the sort of slightly less successful men. And the incels see themselves right at the bottom of the pile. You know, in their eyes, they're like short, they're unattractive, they can't get women, they can't get sex. And so it's the, you're right, the only people beneath them on this scale are women, and it's just like they want to have somebody to oppress, somebody to be better than. You know, they feel so terrible about themselves. But then the other thing that was really surprising to me was that these incels online, you know, I spent a lot of time interviewing incels and being on incel message boards, and their boards are a really weird mix of like horrifying misogyny and racism and like awful, awful things. That's very real. But they're also like weirdly tender and loving and vulnerable with each other in a way that men generally aren't in real life. And it was almost like they were just given up hope of like achieving any status in like traditional masculinity. They were like, we suck so much. We're so, you know, useless in the system that we're just going to give up. And then they were like, it was almost freeing to them online that they were like, okay, well, considering we're never going to get anywhere, we might as well just be vulnerable with each other. And so in some ways, they were really like tender and supportive with one another in a way that I was just not expecting at all.
It makes perfect sense. Is that's the only place where they don't have to overly explain themselves, where they're
Right.
inherently understood
Yeah.
and get empathy And
Yeah, and
right,
they've got
it's
nothing to prove. They don't have to prove how manly they are because they're like, I've already, you know, there's this idea that masculinity is something that boys and men have to constantly prove and reprove. It's precarious, you know, it's always going to slip away. And these incels are just like, okay, we've lost out. We're never going to be that. We're never going to be masculine. We're never going to win in this system. So we might as well just give up and do the thing. And you know, it was strange. And so I think, you know, it's this thing that if we don't give boys and men spaces to connect in real life, if we don't allow them that in better, more healthy places, then they will find it online.
So, how do we best help our boys and give them adequate role models and education in relationship and emotions?
It's a really tricky thing. So I think when I think about this, I tend to sort of split it up into three areas. So they're critical thinking, curiosity, and care and compassion. So critical thinking, I think, is just like naming this problem and giving boys and us and everyone a vocabulary to talk about this and to understand the problem. Because I think we've done a great job with girls and women, you know, that work is not done. But in general, we kind of know. We know what's going on. We can name the problem. We know when something's sexist. We can call it out. We can name it. And even like your average like fifth grade girl can usually tell when something's pretty sexist and sniff it out. Whereas I think with boys, they just don't even really know the contours of the system. And so do, you know, they don't know the way patriarchy harms them. And I think it's the same with adults. Like I think a lot of people read this, but or me myself, when I was researching this, so much of this was a surprise to me. I was like, went into this thinking, oh, boys and men, you know, have everything. They're so privileged. And I just didn't realize how harmful this system was for them. So I think the critical thinking, just to give a voice, a name, call these problems out so it feels like something they can talk about, is one thing. The curiosity piece, I think it's just approaching boys with the same curiosity about their experience that we would do with anyone else and not to sort of shut them down. I think for feminist moms in particular, there's something about a boy saying, oh, things are terrible for boys these days, that we're kind of like, no, it isn't. And then like an hour-long lecture about patriarchy and, you know, gender, you know, how things are terrible for women. And I think boys feel very unheard in this moment. I think they feel like a little bit gaslit. Is that a word? Gaslighted?
Yeah.
Anyway, you know what I mean? That people aren't really acknowledging that things are hard for them and telling them that they're so powerful and privileged, and they don't feel that way. It just does not chime with their experience. So they stop trusting us. They stop, you know, they're like, if we tell them everything is great for them and terrible for girls and women, it just doesn't chime with their actual lived experience. And so I think they just don't, they give up on us. They don't, you know. And so I think if we can really listen and be like, what is life like for you? And not try to reform them or judge them or try to make them better. We're not trying to like use it at, with an agenda to try and make them into something else, but just like, who are you and what's your life like? And then the care and compassion piece, it's exactly what you were talking about just kind of correcting. Boys are so starved of that kind of emotional nurture by parents, by adults, by the culture, by everything they read and watch, by their friends. They need it. They might be really brittle and seem like they don't want it, but we need to give it to them and to help them feel cared for as though they're being, that we're on their side, that we're advocating for them, that we're touching them, that we're giving them, you know, that we're talking to them about their feelings, we're listening to them about that, listening to their feelings, and giving them the same kind of nurture and connection that we would give a girl, meeting them where they are and just trying to build the best relationship possible with them, you know, the
Absolutely.
unique individual child that you have.
Yeah. It reminds me, my friend Christina Kuzmich wrote a book called I Can Fix This about her son's suicidal ideation, and he was in and out of therapies for substance abuse. And she said toward the end of the book that she's just learned how to say, tell me what it's like to be you. Tell me what it feels like to be you.
Absolutely. And not trying, no agenda, not trying to like make him different, reform him. You know, people that boys, the boys I talked to felt so unheard from everywhere. You know, for every like, there was like the right wing tough guy saying, man up, don't express your feelings. There was like the left wing kind of progressive saying, shut up, your voice doesn't matter. You're taking up too much space. You're toxic. You're terrible. nobody was really interested, and there was all this undernurture. They didn't have friends that they could talk to. They just needed people to listen to them in a really profound way.
Absolutely. And I always like to say when we're talking about child raising and parenting and development that nobody requires you to be perfect.
Absolutely. Oh, God. I mean, thank God, because none of us are, and I'm certainly not, and learning and growing all the time. But
Yeah,
yeah.
absolutely. Yeah, it seems it's I know I get overwhelmed and the burden's the wrong word, but the responsibility feels so huge that
Oh,
oftentimes I can find myself
yeah.
getting kind of in a perfectionistic thinking
Yeah. And
mode.
it's like, I think people, I do these talks and things, and people are like, what do I say to my son about this? What do I say to my son about porn? What do I say to my son about consent? And it's like, I don't know, because I don't know your son and I don't know you. And it's like, your son will respond to you being your real authentic self and showing up as the person that you are in connection with the person that he is, not trying to follow a script or like, there's no script. We're just humans, like doing. And I think, teenagers can smell it a mile away if you're not being authentic, but just show up in relationship with that actual individual human in the best, most loving, most nurturing way you can.
Absolutely. Ruth, how can people find out more about your book and your work?
Oh, so the book is called Boy Mom, Reimagining Boyhood in the Age of Impossible Masculinity. You can buy it wherever you get books or get it from the library. And I have a Substack. I'm on, well, I have a Substack called I Blame Society, which you can find on Substack under my name, Ruth Whitman. And I'm on Instagram and sort of on X a little bit reluctantly. But yeah, find me online. My name is unusual, so if it looks like me, then it's me usually.
Two peas.
Two peas, exactly.
Ruth, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you, it was such a pleasure.